Mr. Walker.
May it please the Court, Lucas Walker for the appellant Gerald Williams. The sole contested issue at Mr. Williams' trial was whether Mr. Williams shot Don Smith in self-defense, even though Smith had just punched Williams repeatedly in the face and threatened him with a gun. The prosecution urged that it was really animosity, not fear, that caused Williams to shoot Smith. The question here is whether the admission of Smith's uncross-examined, untested statement that Williams was supposed to be looking for him, was out to get him, was an unreasonable application of Ohio v. Roberts and Tennessee v. Street. It was unreasonable for three reasons. First, the state court misapprehended what it means for a statement to be hearsay. Under Roberts and Street, a statement is hearsay when the reason for offering it depends on the truth of its contents and the credibility of the speaker. Here, the state court thought Smith's statement was not hearsay because it proved only why Smith entered the gas station where the shooting occurred. That was plainly wrong. The statement was hearsay.
Don't you want, before you address the merits, to get to the point that the district court initially dismissed this on procedural grounds?
I believe the state has conceded has chosen to abandon and waive that ground for affirming the judgment.
Confessions of error may or may not be accepted by a court.
Well, I'm not sure if it was an acceptance of error rather than abandoning the argument, but in any event, I'm obviously content to rest on the arguments in the briefs as to why it was an obdurate or contumacious failure to comply with the court's orders to file a brief. As a pro se litigant, his urgence that the court should consider the state briefs that were before the court should be taken as incorporating them by reference and bringing the arguments before the court that way. But, returning to the question of whether it was hearsay, the statement was hearsay because it explained why Smith entered the station only if Smith was speaking the truth. If he was lying when he said that Williams was supposed to be looking for him, then the statement couldn't explain his actions. He entered for some other reason. Second, even if proving why Smith entered the station was conceivably a non-hearsay use of the statement, this Court's decision in another AEDPA case, Jones v. Basinger, makes clear that it could not be admitted for a collateral and insignificant purpose. The prosecution can't smuggle in highly prejudicial hearsay under the guise of providing irrelevant background or context information, and the state has never identified any way in which Smith's reason for entering the station was relevant to the case or in need of explanation. Third,
well, it was relevant to the self-defense defense, right?
It wasn't.
To show what Smith was thinking?
No, I don't believe
and
so.
Why he took the actions that he did?
It wouldn't have any bearing on whether Mr. Williams was acting in self-defense, unless you took it to mean that Mr. Williams was actually.
Well, this is a shootout, right? So why people are chasing each other and shooting at each other is relevant, right? Just at least what impressions they were under, not whether Williams was actually looking for Smith, your client.
Well, if we're looking for what the impression that Smith was under is that he pulled into a gas station and accosted and threatened a man that he ambushed there. And so if we really are curious as to why he went in there, there was other evidence that was less prejudicial that didn't include this hearsay accusation against Mr. Williams.
But the point is that it wasn't offered to show whether or not Williams was actually out looking for Smith. Williams, your client, was actually out looking for Smith, which is what the statement actually says. So, mm-hmm. In fact, it was not offered for its truth. It was offered to show why Smith did what he did in pursuing your client in the gas station and then continuing the fight and escalating it from there.
Well, it shows what Smith did what he did only if Smith was speaking truthfully, if he was a credible witness.
No, only if that's what he thought. It doesn't require that what he thought was true.
Yes, but it was an assertion, I believe that he's out looking for me, which could have been false. He may not have believed that, and so it wouldn't have explained the motivation behind his actions.
I think you're missing the import of my question. It wasn't offered to show that Williams actually was out looking for Smith. It
yes.
was offered to show the impression that Smith was under to explain why he did what he did and what happened after that, the escalation of the altercation and then the shootout.
Yes, but then the statement was Smith's expression of what his impression at the time was. And it, that, that is still, you know, it depends on his credibility and whether he was giving his accurately reflecting his thought processes at the time.
It's not a credibility question. He's dead. He's not a witness. Right?
Well, yeah, exactly. So but whether he was speaking truthfully or not...
doesn't matter. That's my point. It's not offered for the truth. It's...
Yes, but if he was lying, if he didn't even believe that Mr. Williams was out looking for him, then he entered for a different reason. And the fact is, if even if it were a non-hearsay purpose to admit it because it only explains his reasons for doing it, that wouldn't have been permissible because it's you know, ultimately a collateral, insignificant, matter that doesn't go to anything that's really contested in the case. The only issue was self-defense, and there was no dispute that Smith came in because he had some axe to grind with Mr. Williams. And admitting the statement was not harmless either. The sole disputed issue, again, was whether there was self-defense, and the hearsay statement was the only real evidence that supported the government's theory that it was actually animosity pre-existing between the men and not genuine fear for Mr. Williams' life that led him to shoot as he was trying to escape the scene. And so there's every reason to think that the statement actually did influence the jury's verdict. And just, again, returning to the question of hearsay, you know, the state court believed it wasn't hearsay because it could prove why Smith entered the station by the mere fact that it was said. But the mere fact that something is said doesn't guarantee that it's a true reason for why the person did what they did. It could be an alibi.
That's a jury question, though. That doesn't have anything to do with admissibility.
Well, there have to be indicia of reliability, and the jury didn't have any way of assessing its reliability. That's why we usually require that these sort of statements come in only if there's been an opportunity to cross-examine. And it wasn't a situation where the mere fact that something is said proved something regardless of whether it's true or not. It didn't have effect on someone else who was listening, who then responded accordingly. And it didn't even reflect that Smith recognized Mr. Williams in the parking lot. He didn't use his name. And turning again to the question of prejudice, we're looking at how the presence of the statement influenced the jury's consideration of the evidence before it. It's not just whether, absent the statement, there would have been sufficient evidence to convict. And here we had an animosity theory that pervaded the government's argument against self-defense. But the only evidence that the state had was actually contradicted by the person who gave it. They entered the summary notes of someone who interviewed James Kane, who said that there was animosity between the men. That's all the statement said. But Mr. Kane testified as a government witness that actually any animosity was only on one end. It was Mr. Smith's animosity toward Mr. Williams. And so notwithstanding the fact that the government urged animosity repeatedly in its closing, apart from this hearsay statement suggesting that Mr. Williams was out looking for Smith, there wasn't anything meaningfully supporting that that ground for conviction. And I believe I've entered past my rebuttal time.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Mr. Ganser.
May it please the Court. Addressing first the question, Your Honor, addressed to Mr. Walker with respect to the district court's initial ground for dismissing the case of the defendant's failure, the habeas petitioner's failure to prosecute. Mr. Walker has suggested that our response to that matter, which was in essence to, I believe as Your Honor has correctly described it, to confess that we believe that that is not a substantial ground for sustaining the district court's judgment, He has suggested that we have abandoned or waived the argument. The point I simply wish to make is the respondent in this case never suggested to the district court nor asked that the district court dismiss the case because of the failure of Mr.
I don't see why the lack of request from the state matters. District judges have a right to defend themselves against impositional litigation.
Absolutely.
One reason why I bring this up, I don't want to complicate cases unduly, but it doesn't look like any of the lawyers is aware that the Supreme Court now has under advisement the question whether roughly what the state has done here counts as a forfeiture which a court can elect to ignore or as a waiver which is binding on the court. The case is Wood against Milliard. It was argued the 27th of February in the Supreme Court. And in that case, the state had said, roughly, we are not arguing X. And the case was nonetheless decided on ground X, and the Supreme Court is deciding whether we are not arguing X amounts to a waiver of X or is just a forfeiture. The Supreme Court said many times that on collateral review, the party's forfeitures don't bind the court. Now, maybe we should just bypass this and let the Supreme Court decide what it decides. But how would you classify what's in your brief? Is it a waiver, a forfeiture, or a confession of error?
Your Honor, I think fairly within the terms of this discussion, it should be regarded as a confession of error. The position
right,
that
well, it's well established that confessions of error aren't binding on the courts. The Supreme Court says over and over
absolutely.
When a confession of error is made that the court has an independent obligation to determine whether the confession of error is correct.
Absolutely. And that is why in our brief we suggested and requested to this court, obviously without reference to a mandatory principle that this court must be obliged to follow, that we suggested to this court that it simply not deal with that matter, and instead deal with the merits of the question.
That, of course, might be the most sensible thing to do, given the pendency of Wood against Milliard. But
precisely.
You have to think about it intelligently rather than just do it by rote.
Oh, yeah, I understand, Your Honor, and I appreciate the point. I suppose the best way to describe, just to make it clear, that I am suggesting that, not suggesting, stating that we are acknowledging that this is not a ground upon which we believe this case need be decided, is that, in essence, the determination by the district court that the case should be dismissed because the defendant, in the district court's view, chose not to prosecute the case was erroneous, providing us with, in essence, a gift horse that, frankly, we chose not to accept. We believe that, in fact, under the very cases that my opponent, Mr. Walker, has been arguing here, that there was good reason for the court to do precisely as it did do in this case, which is proceed to reach the merits. The failure of the defendant to file a brief for reasons that he gave to the court clearly did not prevent the district court from being able to reach and, in fact,
I understand that, but from the district court's perspective, the district court has entered an order and a party has refused to comply. Even if the district court can carry out its job in the face of deliberate noncompliance by a party, district courts have the authority to enforce their orders.
Right.
And when a plaintiff tells a district court, I'm not going to follow your order, the normal thing that happens is dismissal for want of prosecution.
In addition to the what we've already pointed out here, Your Honor, and I would simply point out as well that the response that Mr. Williams did in fact file with the court could well have been regarded by the district court as could well have been deemed as. Mm-hmm. The sum, substance, and beginning in alpha and omega of Mr. Williams's arguments to the court. But in addition to the very reason that Your Honor Hurt suggested, that perhaps we ought to wait until the United States Supreme Court has provided definitive guidance on this for this matter to be dealt with in a dispositive fashion before this court. Addressing the merits of this case, if I may, which were reached by the district court, it's perfectly clear that the controversy that has survived for appeal before this court of the multiple issues that were raised by Mr. Williams before the district court, deals with the mere statement during the testimony of one witness describing the course of events immediately preceding what became a confrontation between the victim, Donald Smith, and the petitioner, defendant in the state court, Mr. Williams, was a statement by the passenger in the car being driven by the victim, Mr. Smith, that he, referencing Mr. Smith, told me, this is after apparently a car in which Mr. Williams had pulled up next to the car driven by Mr. Smith near a filling station. He, Mr. Smith, told me, this is Mr. Covington speaking, this, using the N-word, supposed to be looking for me. So, Mr. Smith said, testifying to from his own personal knowledge and observation, he pulled up to the gas station. The controversy in this case is this individual, Mr. Williams, supposed to be looking for me. That was the only reference in the trial testimony to this, to a comment by Mr. Smith in this respect. It was immediately objected to. In fact, the judge raised the question whether or not the defense wanted to object to the statement on the basis of hearsay. The judge raised the question to, in fact, to the prosecution, was it hearsay? The defense objected, and the judge ruled, accepting the state's very briefly stated position, that the statement should not be regarded as hearsay because it goes to, in the prosecutor's language, it goes to explain what happened next. The judge then specifically instructed the jury that the statement of Mr. Smith, including the use of the derogatory racial term, which the court properly referred to as an offensive term, to describe Mr. Smith looking for Mr. Williams looking for Mr. Smith, is testimony that's been offered to explain what happened next, but you should not accept it, the statement, for its truth, because the person who said those words is not here today to tell us whether those words are true or not. I think this was a careful, considered, and appropriate ruling by the court, with a limiting instruction to the jury telling them they could simply regard the statement by Mr. Smith through Mr. Covington, the hearsay statement, the out-of-court statement being testified to, simply for the purpose of saying why this was the beginning of what was then to be recounted in testimony from people with personal knowledge about what then happened. But the statement itself, that Mr. Williams, supposed to be looking for Mr. Smith, was not to be accepted as true because there was no way that the jury, the fact finders in this case, were in a position to assess whether it was true or not, simply because, of course, Mr. Smith, the decedent, was no longer available. Mr. Walker, Mr. Williams, acting through Mr. Walker, has structured a fine argument before this court on what he believes is the prejudicial effect of this simple statement made in the course of a lengthy trial. But we would submit to this court, Your Honor, that this was a simple, short episode in the midst of a trial to which the court properly responded with an appropriate ruling under Wisconsin evidence law, that this statement, if considered for any purpose, could only be considered for the purpose of explaining what happened next, providing the opening scene in what would then happen next. We do know, of course, that Mr. Williams did pull that Mr. Smith, driving his car, did stop in the filling station, that he then did have a confrontation with Mr. Williams, that over the course of several moments later, after they had separated, resulted in gunfire by Mr. Williams, resulting in the death of Mr. Smith. The statement itself, "he's supposed to be looking for me," has no role in this case of an inculpatory or incriminating nature other than to set the scene for what happened in the moments after the two men came into personal confrontation at the filling station. This is not a case in which we believe there has been a violation of the defendant's confrontation clause rights, nor is there a basis here.
Thank you, counsel.
For reversal. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Walker?
Just addressing very quickly the merits of the dismissal for failure to prosecute. Mr. Williams repeatedly explained to the court that he could not file because of his illiteracy and his psychological learning disability. And so it was not obdurance or contumacious behavior in failing to do it. And as this court has directed district courts, if they're able to resolve on the merits, they should do so. And here, as in Piggy, there was prior briefing before the court addressing precisely the claims at issue. And finally, on the question of hearsay, the events spoke from themselves. There was no need to have an accusation against Mr. Williams in order for the jury to understand anything else that was happening. And so the notion that the jury would have simply ignored the clinging reverberations of the accusation, as the Supreme Court said in Shepard, in favor of this very collateral point of pulling in, of the reason for pulling in when it was clear why he did that, was not proper. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. Walker. And, Mr. Walker, we appreciate your willingness and that of your firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.